Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 183 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com if you want to talk to me. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. Listen over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990. We have a long interview this week, so let's get on to the important question of whether viruses really exist. James McCumsky has a degree in electronic engineering from University College Dublin and worked as an engineer for Swedish telecom giant Ericsson for 10 years. After that, he obtained the status of fellow chartered certified accountant and is currently a finance manager. But we're not going to talk about all that. James became interested in alternatives to standard medicine when his father got liver cancer. He's an advocate of German new medicine created by Dr. Reich Geird Hammer. And he also follows Isadora Laker from Toronto. But we're not really going to talk about that. But we are going to talk about his questioning of the virus paradigm. And by questioning, I mean questioning everything. The question about whether viruses exist or have for decades, perhaps centuries, been a great fraud on the world. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes.
Pleasure to be here.
So I can understand being interested in alternative medicine or alternatives to, say, allopathic medicine because your father got liver cancer. And if you'd like, you can talk about how that changed your worldview. But how did that get you interested in the existence of viruses?
Okay, so when a loved one gets cancer, you're looking for all possible solutions. And with liver cancer, it's modern medicine says it's terminal and that's it.
Right.
So you're kind of going around looking for solutions. My sister had, very briefly, she had come across the new medicine. I studied it myself. Isadora Laker had the first kind of website, and she's based in Toronto, Canada. She had the first website in English, and she's still very much active about the new medicine. And I kind of studied that. I worked with Harold Baumann. Studied some stuff from Harold Baumann, who's a Swiss G&M therapist. And then I learned about the five biological laws. And then the third biological law is that every so-called conflict has got two phases, conflict active phase and then the resolution phase. And it's in the resolution phase that we get what's called viral and bacterial infections by modern medicine. And then Dr. Hammer at that time mentioned that he wasn't sure if viruses existed. And then that led me on to Stefan Lanke. Stefan Lanke at that time worked with a guy called Karl Krafelt. And he had an organization called Klein Klein Action, which means small, small actions. And the idea there was that ordinary people like me who have no training whatsoever in biology or medicine, write to the authorities and ask them for proof of the existence of any virus. And that's how I got going on all of this about 10 years ago. You write to the kind of authorities like the Minister for Health or the World Health Organization, no response or meaningless response. Minister for Health in Ireland refers me to the World Health Organization. World Health Organization does not respond. And then you start going to the relevant professionals, like the Health Protection Surveillance Centre in Ireland is responsible for infectious diseases. And then you start going to, and then finally I nailed down the National Virus Reference Laboratory based at University College Dublin, Ireland. And the National Virus Reference Laboratory is a very good name because they are the people responsible for identifying viruses. And now I've been asking them, laterally, I finally identified the responsible technical group in Ireland for the identification of so-called pathogenic viruses. And I've written an email. I think I've copied you in quite a few of my emails.
Yes, you have.
To the NVRL. And also I've focused on the measles virus laterally. The reason why I've focused on the measles virus is because Dr. Stefan Lanke, I can go into this case with you in more detail, but Dr. Stefan Lanke basically, he placed a bet that nobody could provide proof for the existence of the measles virus. A German doctor challenged him with, I think, 8 or 9 papers, scientific papers.
Six papers. Yeah, I interviewed Dr. Stefan Lanke, and we talked about this somewhat. But I think your summary was actually better than Dr. Lanke's summary in some ways. I mean, maybe we should start with this. I can read you the 4 arguments that you summarized his case at.
Okay.
And this is what you said. Dr. Lanke hired 2 independent laboratories to investigate the alleged measles virus. They both confirmed that the typical gene sequence of quite normal healthy cells has been wrongly interpreted as a central component of parts of the measles virus. So short genetic sequences from normal healthy cells have been arbitrarily assembled together in order to make up a model of the measles virus, and this is stated to be the genome of the measles virus. So do you want to talk about that argument against the measles virus?
Okay. You have to appreciate I need to read over this stuff again. I haven't fully read over it again, but I know what I wrote. But basically, the idea there being is that they take, say somebody's got a child's got measles, and they take a blood sample from the child with measles. And what they try to do is they assume that the measles virus is in there, and they take the bits out and they multiply them using this PCR technique, mm-hmm. and they try to assemble the genome sequence. But it's quite clear from the scientific papers when you actually do read them, and when I actually force myself to read them, that they have not isolated the virus in the first place.
Right. I mean, the logical way to obtain a genome of a virus would be to purify the virus.
Yes.
And then the virus would be proteins plus either DNA or RNA, and then separate the proteins and the DNA and the RNA, and then sequence what you have. And if every sample you do it has a very similar sequence, you can say, okay, well, this is the sequence of this particle. Now, that hasn't proved that the particle is actually pathogenic. That's another question. But it has at least proved that it came from the particles you saw in a pure sample under an electron microscope. Yeah. So
correct.
We agree on that.
Well, the point that, like for example, one of the scientific papers, like for example, a guy called Dr. Jeff Connell at the National Virus Laboratory, Reference Laboratory, Dublin, Ireland, he sent me 2 scientific papers, and one of them I think was on the influenza A virus, and basically what it says somewhere is that the guy basically reproduced the 90% of the genome sequence, and he believes that that is. Isolate. I mean, it's called influenza A virus isolation culture and identification. Mm-hmm. But the point being is they've tried to produce the model, the genome sequence from these fragments, and they believe they've kind of artificially assembled it together. But the reality is they have not purified the virus, and even they admit it in the paper. They do not isolate. Purify the so-called pathogenic virus, whatever it is.
Right. We have to be very careful about the word isolation, because virologists have debased the word virus isolation, the phrase virus isolation, to mean absolutely nothing. And basically any signal that can be possibly interpreted as a virus is called isolation. But when you talk about purification, they for some reason don't like to abuse the word purification as much, and so they just don't use it because they haven't purified it. And it's interesting that you're saying that they couldn't even get a single coherent genome, that this guy had to piece it together in pieces.
Yeah, that's correct. And the whole point is that it's basically, I mean, you're reading these papers, and, I mean, I'll be brutally honest about it, I've only read 2 papers, really studied them myself, 2 scientific papers, the isolation of a novel coronavirus and the influenza A virus isolation, which were given to me by Dr. Jeff Connell. But it's quite clear when you look at them that they call it an isolate. If somebody had a sputum, somebody's got the novel coronavirus and they spit something out. They call that an isolate.
Which is clearly not isolate.
No, but I mean, it's ridiculous. To call that an isolate is just, it defies common sense. I spit out sputum and that's an isolate. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You know,
they're not kidding. They're deadly serious. I mean, that's what I mean about the term isolation, isolate. Basically, anything they want to call an isolate is an isolate. Anything they want to call isolation is isolation. Like, I've seen papers where they've added impure materials to a cell culture, and cells in the cell culture died, and they've called that isolation of the virus. Well, who knows? I mean, it could be some toxin that you've introduced. It could be some, other reaction, some biological reaction that caused the cells to be killed.
Yes, and basically, I mean, I'm going back and forth to the National Virus Reference Board. They have to come back to me now, and I've asked them. So basically, using the language, it's kind of like legal language. I've asked them for the record. Can they produce a scientific record which states how the measles virus was, just to pick one pathogenic virus. And the reason why I'm picking the measles virus is because we vaccinate our children against measles. Mm-hmm. The question is, if we vaccinate our children against measles, then presumably the measles virus exists, okay? And I've asked them for the record where anybody has isolated the measles virus. They have not been able to provide the record. Now, the interesting thing with Dr. Lanka, and you corrected me, six scientific papers that Dr. David Bardens presented. Mm-hmm. And one of them was by I forget the guy's name, but he won a Nobel Prize for the so-called isolation of the polio virus, Enders.
Okay.
Enders Peeble paper. Enders, I forget his first name, Enders won the Nobel Prize for the polio virus that year. And then he used the same kind of technique to isolate the measles virus. But interestingly, that particular paper, the authorities in Germany have said that none of those scientific papers, what the legal case in Germany proved, that none of those scientific papers, either individually or collectively, prove the existence of the measles virus.
Well, if I can go back to that, I said there were four things that you'd brought up.
Yes,
let's go to number four. The current belief in the existence of the measles virus can be traced back to the influential paper published by Enders and Peeble in 1954. However, this paper does not prove the existence of the measles virus. The authors observed the death of cells in the test tube and believed that this was caused by the phantom measles virus. However, as per another argument, they did not carry out any control experiments. If they had carried them out, they would have determined that their preparation of the test tube caused the death of the cells and that the observed death of cells had nothing to do with the alleged measles virus. That's pretty incredible that in 1954, people would do isolation experiments without a control.
Yeah, well, my understanding, now you correct me if I'm wrong here, my understanding, and I have taught myself German reading technical German, which is quite difficult because
the
big long words are put together. But Dr. Stefan Lanka is saying the problem with biology today, or in general, is that they do not do any control experiments. So they do not test whether their methods of preparation of the test tube caused the cells to die without, that they were perfectly healthy cells to die if they did not come from a so-called isolate that was had the measles virus. So they do not do any control experiments. That's my understanding. And even today, they do not do it.
And well, I don't think that's quite true. I think it may be true in effect. Like I believe that what they would do is, for example, if they have a cell culture and they're going to add quote the measles virus. So say they take sputum or blood serum or whatever, and add it to the cell culture. They may have as a control a cell culture without that. But here you have the purification problem. If you add, say, sputum to a cell culture, the vast majority of that material is non-viral. I mean, because viruses are so small.
Correct.
So it's not a proper control. So I would say they have controls, but they're not proper controls. Just like in vaccine trials, they often have a placebo, but it's not a proper placebo because it might contain some of the materials such as aluminum that are potentially toxic. And so if you compare aluminum plus biological against aluminum without biological, you can say what the effect of the biological component is, but not the aluminum component.
But I guess just for a general listener might say, oh, this is all very complicated. But maybe I should just back up a little bit. How Dr. Stefan Lanka got into this in the early 80s was he isolated what's called a giant virus, which is, from memory, it was the marine brown algae Ectocarpus sidicolosis virus, which has got a diameter of approximately 120 nanometers. And he isolated that, and he believed that he had discovered the first non-pathogenic virus. So this virus goes on the marine brown algae, and in some way it has a symbiotic relationship with it, helps it in cold water or something. I'm not quite sure exactly what it does, but it has a symbiotic relationship. But anyway, he isolated this particular virus, measured its diameter, 120 nanometers, and what he's saying now is that in 1 liter of seawater, there are thousands of these non-pathogenic so-called giant viruses. And then so he was able to isolate it. And then around this time, obviously, the HIV, the AIDS kind of scare was at its height.
Right.
And he kind of was amazed to discover that nobody had ever isolated the HIV virus.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the HIV, so he spent I think the initial couple of years, you know, publicizing about the HIV virus. And then he got into the whole all the so-called pathogenic viruses against which we vaccinate our children, like mumps, measles, rubella, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there is no evidence that they exist. And the key point is that they have never been isolated. It's as simple as that. You know, when you cut to the chase, they've never been isolated. And what
let's be careful with that word, because virologists
purified.
Isolation comes from the Latin word isola, or Italian isola, which means island, which clearly means something separated from something else. The problem, I guess, with viruses is that something so fragile as a virus can't be separated from everything else, because it would just like break apart and dry. But you could say, okay, a virus that's in some inert material like water or saline solution or something else that would help preserve it, we could adjust it to say, okay, that's isolation. But as you say, a sputum or a blood serum or the liquid coming off a cell culture, that is not, by any stretch of the imagination, isolation or purification, which should mean the same thing.
Yes. None of these viruses have been isolated. It's just, or have been purified. I'll use that technical
term. Yeah, stick with purification.
None of them have been purified. And the whole point, and what Stefan Anke is saying is, now, I'm interested in your views on this, because I'm not a biologist, but what he's saying is, my understanding is, he's saying the density centrifugation technique, and my understanding is, you put the serum, the sputum, or whatever it is, a sample, into a test tube, with a particular type of material in the test tube, and you centrifuge, you spin it around pretty fast, and it separates out according to density, and if there was a pathogenic virus there, you'd be able to get it in a kind of a layer around in the test
right.
tube, and you'd be able to extract it, and you would have a purified virus.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that is exactly what he did with these so-called giant viruses. So the point, my understanding is, these giant viruses have a diameter of 120 to 150 nanometers. And the so-called pathogenic viruses like mumps, measles, and rubella apparently are 80 to 90. So they're just a little bit smaller.
Tell me your understanding of the density centrifugation and the importance of that.
Okay. I have read Dr. Stefan Lanke's material in German and translated it. And basically what he's saying to me is the standard technique that's referenced in the medical textbooks, biology textbooks, for the purification of viruses is the density centrifugation technique. Okay? That's what he says. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that?
Well, okay. So it depends how far you take it, because density centrifugation by itself, it sorts things by density. And so if there was a virus of a particular size, of a consistent size, and you centrifuged the material, I think they use a sucrose gradient, then it would all go to a certain place. But the problem is that there may well be other things that go to the same place. And there were two papers published in March 1997, both in the same issue of the Journal of Virology or something like that. And they examined this material for the first time. That's 1997. I mean, HIV was supposedly isolated in 1984. And they discovered, they said in the paper, that at least 90% of what they saw was impurities. So you can't just centrifuge. You also have to look at the material you have and show that it's actually pure.
Okay. But in other words, okay, what he is saying very clearly that in the case of the measles virus, if we just restrict it to the measles virus because that's the one that's probably the best documented, what he's saying is that what they believe when they put together their genome sequence is just a normal part. It's just a normal part. He said what they believe to be measles virus is just cellular components. Simple as that.
Mm-hmm. But
okay. And the whole point is, if the measles virus did exist, it would be possible with the density centrifugation technique to get it to purify it. And he's saying the reason why they cannot purify it is because the measles virus or any other pathogenic virus, HIV, rubella, novel coronavirus, influenza A virus, whatever, none of them exist. And that is basically it. And what I think the key point, David, if you don't mind me saying so, is that he's isolated so-called non-pathogenic viruses, the giant viruses, such as the marine brown algae, Ectocarpus silicosis virus. Mm-hmm. Apparently, in 1 liter of seawater, there are thousands of these viruses. They're all non-pathogenic. And apparently, my understanding is at least a couple of hundred of them have been isolated or purified already, and papers have been written about them. And the point is that if it's possible to isolate these non-pathogenic giant viruses, why can't you isolate the smaller, slightly smaller, allegedly pathogenic viruses? And what Stefan Lanke is saying, certainly in the case of measles, is just a normal component part of cells. So in other words, it would appear that if a child has got measles, that there's a change in the cellular composition or whatever it is. It looks a bit different maybe from normal cells if the child doesn't have measles. And they believe that this change is caused by an external agent called the measles virus. But the problem is, and it really is a very, very simple problem. They've not been able to isolate it or to purify it.
Well, that brings up a question. Your second argument, summarizing Stefan Lanke's arguments against the existence of measles virus, was Professor Andreas Podbielski testified at the measles virus trial along with four other technical experts. All five confirmed that the entire area of measles virology is extremely unscientific because of no control experiments being carried out. So my question is, did they get this genome? Presumably they got this genome from, body fluids of sick children or sick adults, whatever. Did they try to extract the same materials out of healthy adults or healthy children?
Well, my understanding is, according to Stefan Lanke, they don't do any control experiments. That's the whole point. I mean, I'm just summarizing what he's written about it. I didn't study those six scientific papers in full detail. And I'm just summarizing what he's written about it in German and trying to understand it myself. But that is definitely my understanding, that they do not do the control experiments. And to be honest with you, I've asked the questions now of the National Virus Reference Laboratory in Dublin, Ireland, and they are clearly the reference laboratory in Ireland for the identification of so-called pathogenic viruses. And it's really a simple question. Can you tell me the record, the scientific record, for somebody who's written a scientific paper where somebody claims to have purified the Mises virus? Now, interestingly, they don't give the Anders Peeble paper. They don't give any paper. They just say no record exists. And then you ask them, the next question is, and this is the question I've asked them, is can they create the record? Can they create the scientific paper? And I'm asking them, are they willing to do the experiment, carry out an experiment? The child's got measles, either blood sample or sputum, whatever it is, and do the density centrifugation and try to isolate the measles virus. And then I also suggested, as a control experiment, they would use the density centrifugation technique to isolate one of these so-called giant viruses that exist in seawater. And if they're able to isolate one of those viruses, then how come, which are non-pathogenic, then how come they can't isolate the so-called pathogenic viruses? I mean, this is, in a way, this is kind of logic according to Dr. Spock from Star Trek, you know?
Right. Well, yeah. Okay, I still see one problem with that methodology. Like, let's say that we decide that we're going to use sputum, and we take sputum from children who are sick with the measles. We put it in a cell culture. We do our magic. We take the what they call a supernatant, or the liquid that floats on the cell culture. We do density centrifugation on that. I mean, that's the kind of thing they do with HIV. And then we find, at a certain density, we find, miraculously find, a whole bunch of unique particles, right? But there's still a problem, because now we say, okay, we're going to need a control. So you take sputum from a healthy child, do exactly the same thing, you don't find those particles. The problem is you have the cell culture in the middle. So if there is a difference in the body of the child with measles, then that could influence the cell culture in a non-pathogenic way, and it could cause, from a sick child, could cause the creation of particles which you would mistake for viruses. I think until you've taken those viruses and injected them into an animal and produced disease, that you still haven't proven anything.
Yes, exactly. So where I got into this was like Koch's postulates. Robert Koch was the guy, one of the earliest guys involved in the germ theory, like particularly in relation to bacteria. And his first thing in relation to bacteria is postulate one: you observe what you believe to be the pathogen in the sputum or in the cellular culture. Number two, you are able to purify it, grow it. Number three, you're able to inject it into another person, another animal, and cause the same disease. And then number four, you're able to isolate it again from that human being or animal. Now, the point is, in relation to bacteria do exist. You're able to observe them. But the point is, if you, for example, I mean, Max von Pettenkofer, in the early 1900s, carried out the experiment, if somebody would... tubercular bacilli, and he drank a whole bowlful of them, didn't get tuberculosis. His assistant did the same thing. So the point is, if tubercular bacilli caused tuberculosis, then you'd imagine if you drank, a bowl of them, you should get the same disease. So he didn't.
There was a similar experiment during the 1918 flu epidemic, where they took some prisoners and they offered them some benefit, like a shorter sentence or something, if they would participate in this experiment. And what they basically did is they took nasal secretions from people dying of the flu, and then they swabbed it in the nose of these poor prisoners. And the result was that none of the prisoners got sick.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but the point is, so exactly. Now, so if those people that had the flu had what was caused by this pathogen called whatever the flu virus was at the time, the influenza A virus, whatever it was, and if they put it onto the, but then that's explained Interestingly enough, that is all explained by the fact that the prisoners had a very good, healthy immune system. You know, so I mean, the whole problem with like modern medicine, I mean, like my understanding, like I wrote a book about it called, when I discovered all this, called The Ultimate Conspiracy of Biomedical Paradigm. And my understanding is the germ theory of disease in modern medicine is the equivalent to the resurrection in Christianity. So obviously, and I am a Christian, if you're a Christian, you believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead on the third day. That is a key dogma of Christianity. Mm. That didn't happen. If that didn't happen, then there's no point in believing it. Christianity is a meaningless religion. But the key point with modern medicine is this belief in the germ theory of disease. So Max von Pettenkopf proved it with tubercular bacilli, which are bacteria, that you drank a bowl of them, didn't get tuberculosis. Your experiment that you've highlighted proves that you can't pass on the so-called somebody with measles or somebody with the flu from one person to another. It failed. And presumably it failed. The prisoners were thinking, we're going to get reduced time, get out of jail quicker. They were feeling good about it. And because of that, they were fine, you know? Absolutely.
There was another great experiment that was accidentally created during the SARS epidemic. SARS started in the Chinese province of Guangdong, and I think the capital city is Guangzhou. Or maybe it's the other way around. I think Guangdong is the province and Guangzhou is the city. Anyway, that's where SARS supposedly originated from. There were hundreds of cases, although very relatively minor consequences, as opposed to in Canada, where they had a very high death rate. But anyway, there was this paper written about they accidentally put the SARS patients on the AIDS ward. Now, if you think about it, SARS is this incredibly infectious virus, right? They mm-hmm. said that, you know, in some cases they hypothesized that somebody had been on an elevator and somebody had touched the button on the elevator, and that's how they got the virus, because they couldn't actually prove that these people, despite being in the same hotel, were ever in contact with each other. So it must be incredibly infectious. Now you got AIDS, which is an immune system disorder. So here you got the perfect experiment. You got this incredibly infectious virus, and you've got people with immune suppression. The question is, how many of those people with AIDS came down with SARS? And the answer is zero. And worse yet, they on this floor of the hospital, they had SARS on one side and AIDS on the other. And they had a corridor down the middle where the nurses and doctors would run up and down this corridor. And they had open windows into the rooms on both sides. So you had free airflow. Worse yet, one AIDS patient was accidentally put in with the SARS patients in a room with the SARS patients, or vice versa. So you had a direct mixing of these people. Plus you had like a little sitting areas at both ends of the floor where the patients could sit at any time. So you had uncontrolled mingling of these two groups of people. Again, nobody got sick, and nobody can understand how this deadly, this incredibly infectious virus didn't infect anybody with a compromised immune system. But that kind of stuff doesn't slow down the viral paradigm, unfortunately.
No, it doesn't. And I just think that what Stefan Lang is trying to do is just, in particular, you know, with this whole, my understanding now of the case in Germany, none of these six scientific papers prove the existence of the measles virus. He didn't have to pay 100,000 euros over to Dr. David Bartens. And the German Supreme Court verified the decision of the state court in Stuttgart that it was a perfectly valid legal judgment. But despite that, nothing's happened in Germany either. But there is certainly a lot more awareness. In Germany, they seem to have a culture of alternative healers anyway, like registered kind of Heilpraktiker. I'm not sure how you translate that into English, like healing practitioners.
Right.
But they're alternative medical people. But they seem to have a huge culture of that.
But despite, go ahead.
Yeah, but exactly. But despite all of that, he can't make the breakthrough. And to be honest, I am sure, I'll tell you a story. I've said this to a friend of mine called Declan. I've shown him some of these emails to the National Virus Reference Laboratory in Dublin, Ireland. And he says, oh, it's a bit strange that they don't get back to you. But he's not that concerned. He still believes the official story. And I really think that the only way that we make a breakthrough, I think, I don't know what you think about this, but my view is you're wasting your time talking to your ordinary person because they're just not interested.
Well, you're wasting your time talking to people embedded in the allopathic medical system because they've been brought up with the assumption, it's been drilled into them a million times, that viruses exist and that I don't think there's any question that bacteria exist, but that bacteria are pathogenic. As you pointed out, there's lots of experiments where bacteria don't seem to be infectious. So it's not that they don't exist. The question is the only cause of tuberculosis the tuberculosis bacillus, or are there environmental factors? And if there are environmental factors, maybe we should deal with those. Two items I wanted to bring up. One is you talked about alternative practitioners, but I would bet that the vast majority of alternative practitioners also believe in the viral dogma.
I would totally agree with that because I've met a few of them. They all go along. I actually met a few of them, and they had their children vaccinated. They are,
those who are opposed to vaccination would probably say, if we keep our children's immune system healthy, we don't need to vaccinate against these viruses, as opposed to, do these viruses even exist? And of course, people, if you talk to, as you say, you talk to the ordinary person, they'll say, well, I know viruses exist because I came down with one the other week. And it's okay, you were sick, but even most medical doctors don't have the ability to directly see viruses. I mean, to see a virus is a very complicated process because you need an electron microscope. And then what are you going to prepare to put under the electron microscope? If you take, say, blood serum, which is sort of blood with the lumps removed, the big cells removed, it probably still has lots of little bits and pieces of cellular materials in it. So how are you going to remove all that stuff? And if you put it in a cell culture to try to allow the virus to replicate for a while, then you have the problem that the cell culture contributes its own cellular debris, which is even bigger than pure materials. So even professionals would have an extremely difficult time visualizing a virus, and yet the average person says, I know I had the flu.
But also, I don't know if you've noticed this, that, people seem to have an inbuilt debt. They're deferential to authority. And maybe in the old days, they were deferential to the church. Now they're deferential to the white coats, to the doctors, because they all know the doctors they're all smart people. They've studied a long time, or the PhDs in biology, very smart people. But when you ask these PhDs in biology, can you give me the record where somebody has purified the measles virus? And the fact of the matter is, the National Virus Reference Laboratory, and you've seen the emails, they are unable to provide a record. They just say no record exists. And under freedom of information, they can get away with it because they are, of course, correct. No record does exist because the measles virus does not exist. So nobody has ever purified it. And one other point I'd like to make, David, if you mind. There's this concept of, people say, well, how do you prove it doesn't exist? And the answer is you can't. You cannot prove a negative. There is a concept of, I think it's called positivity in science, that if you make an assertion, or reproducibility, if you make an assertion, you must be able to prove it.
Have you ever heard of Russell's teapot?
No, I vaguely, will you tell me the story?
Yes. So I think it was the great philosopher, scientific philosopher, I think it was Bertrand Russell, and he said, there is a teapot orbiting the sun between Mars and Earth. And he said, that's my hypothesis, so it's your responsibility to prove it's wrong. And it's like, well, I don't have the tools to be able to see something that small so far away. But what his point was, it's not your responsibility to prove that there's no teapot out there. It's his responsibility to provide evidence that there is a teapot orbiting the sun. And it's the same with a virus. It's their responsibility to prove that there is, that these viruses do exist. One thing I wanted to go back to, because I'm actually reading, you're reading Scientific German, I'm reading Old Italian, and I'm reading the report that was written in 1648 of the epidemic of, let me get this right, 1629 to 1632 in the city of Milan. What I found about this is that it was just an assumption that this thing was infectious. And the most incredible things are said about this supposed infection that are obviously completely illogical. And I think like 99% of this report you could clearly throw away because it's absurd, you know, based on 17th century beliefs. And yet the one part that's kept is the fact that it's proven to be an infectious epidemic. But somewhere, and I can no longer remember where this was, somewhere told me that this concept came from at least the Roman Empire and probably before that. And what is this concept? This concept is something that's invisible, but you know that it's out there and you know it's causing disease. Mm-hmm. For example, the title page of this 1648 report says, first word pretty much, contagious, poisonous, and evil. And that's the characteristics of this bacteria or virus that they hypothesized. And yet, today, people will discuss these epidemics and they can discuss the symptoms and they can hypothesize which bacteria or virus it was. But there's actually no reasonable evidence that there was anything contagious out there.
Absolutely. And the same thing with yellow fever, you know. My understanding of yellow fever is that dead bodies were in the river or whatever, or in the lake, and people were drinking water from the river or lake. And when the dead bodies decompose, they produce toxins. And if you drink water with these toxins in it, you will get sick. You will get yellow fever or whatever it is. But then people believe that that is infectious. But it's because they've got the common source, which is the drinking polluted water. And all of this stuff, you know, it's all very interesting. And the belief in these kind of evil bacteria or viruses coming from the outside or coming from a foreign country that you don't like, and they come in and they cause all these diseases. But the point is, just when you get down to just this simple, you know, Occam's razor, what is a simple, you know, where is the proof? And the point is that these scientists, I've asked the question directly, and they just say no record exists. They're not willing to carry out the experiment. They're not willing to carry out a control experiment. They're not really willing to engage, because then the whole house of cards of modern medicine will fall down. And I'm not sure what it takes to get through to them. I mean, I'm certainly hopeful that some of these scientists are going to listen to your show and just understanding that, you know, why can we not purify any of these so-called pathogenic viruses? You know?
Another challenge that is often made to people who question any infection, I mean, even if you only question one infection, like HIV/AIDS or measles or HPV and cervical cancer, the challenge usually is, well, something's causing this illness, and if it's not a virus, what in the hell could it possibly be? I mean, we know, we have scientifically documented, we have vitamin deficiencies that can cause disease. We have toxicities of metals and pesticides and other things that can cause disease. And yet all of that environmental stuff is just ignored. I mean, that this lake with dead bodies, it might not just be dead bodies. I mean, maybe there's a textile mill or a steel factory or something, which is dumping its untreated waste into the lake, right? We don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But one thing I've noticed, like I mean, in a way, it is a simple solution. And I've, you know, I've discussed this with quite a few people. It is a simple solution. Oh, I just got a bad flu virus. That's it. I got a really heavy flu. But then you ask them, well, did anybody else in your family get it? And they didn't. But they can't explain that. But they always say, but people believe that, you know, they got this flu virus. It's got nothing to do with stuff that's going on in their lives or whatever it is that could possibly have caused it. And then they can't explain why the family members didn't get it. And then they're not willing to look at an alternative solution. But in a way, I've more or less given up on trying to talk to ordinary people about this. Really, my focus is on the scientists, is on the people like the National Virus Reference Laboratory in Dublin, Ireland. And I've also contacted, I forget what they're called, the virus reference in England. Which is kind of a virus reference laboratory that recognized by the World Health Organization. I've contacted them, no reply from them just yet. But certainly in the organization in Ireland, they have to respond to me under freedom of information. But again, they can get away with it saying no record exists. But the question is, why does no record exist? Why is there no scientific publication in existence proving the existence of any pathogenic virus?
Yeah,
you know, and really and truly, it's that simple, you know. And to be honest with you, like, although the papers are written in technical English as well, and I, you know, struggle to get through them, but when you do get through them, I mean, what they're saying is quite simple. They call this sputum and isolate, which, you know, defies any kind of rational understanding of what the word isolate should mean. And what they do is they try to construct this genome sequence using a PCR of elements of what they believe to be the virus. And what Dr. Lanka is saying is that they're just normal component parts of the cell.
I remember reading the work of the PROS group, which was done, I think, in the 90s, maybe some in the 80s, on HIV. And they pointed out that in Robert Gallo's work, which was considered seminal until people realized he'd pretty much stolen his work from Montagnier, which doesn't necessarily make it right, but it doesn't make it correct. But the thing they pointed out was that Gallo had rabbit anti-serum to HIV. That implies that HIV had been injected into the rabbits to produce the rabbit anti-serum, but there was never any pure HIV to inject into the rabbits. So it's kind of like there's this circular logic. If he writes it carefully, or he writes a very complicated paper, you might not notice that this circle started somewhere. And if you look at the circle, you realize, well, if we have rabbit anti-serum to HIV, then we must have had an experiment where we produced that. And there isn't such an experiment. And there's a lot of that kind of thing going on. You either take deficient conclusions, like you basically dredge impure materials looking for a genome that looks interesting and you declare that that's the virus, or you might take in a cell culture and you might find six identical particles by looking through massive quantities of the cell culture, and then you say, oh, these are six HIV particles, or there's six HPV particles, or there's six measles particles, or whatever.
In a way, it's kind of, it is laughable, you know. It really is laughable how bad this is. And I mean, but the one maybe ray of good light is that you mentioned earlier that there was two independent laboratories in Germany now confirmed that what they believe to be the measles virus is normal component parts of cells. So maybe the message is getting out among scientists. But the question is, I think what it is when you question something like this, and you're working in a university, presumably you would get fired, you know, or if you're working in a laboratory, if you question that this whole thing is just a load of rubbish, you would be fired from your job. These guys have spent I don't know a long time at university. They believe they're very smart people, and I'm sure they are smart. But they've got a huge amount of vested interest in keeping the game going.
Well, this, yeah. I think it's not a triumph of modern medicine, as I pointed out earlier. Like, if you go back to the 1648 paper, and I'm not saying this is the oldest paper, I'm sure if you went back earlier, you'd have similar things. Of course, the farther you go back, the harder it is to get good written sure. records. But there's a lot of concepts in that paper that are still flogged today. For example, they had the concept of quarantine, which means 40 days in Italian. So this idea that, you know, people are infectious for a fixed duration of time was in there. They had the idea of suspect cases. So, you know, somebody who doesn't have the symptoms that they're looking for, but they hypothesize this person has the illness, maybe because they're in the same house as somebody who got very, very sick. They have this invisible, they're convinced about this invisible substance. In fact, they talk about these people called Antioni, which are people that run around the city, evil people that paint this invisible substance on walls. And if you catch these people, you have to torture them in the most horrible way imaginable. Like, the Italians definitely knew how to kill somebody in an agonizing, horrible way. Because you know that they painted an invisible substance. Well, how could you possibly know this? They even have an experiment documented in this, a very interesting experiment. They took some of this invisible material and they put it on a piece of bread and they fed it to animals. And then within half an hour, all the animals died. And when they cut the animals open, they were all black inside. Now, like, we would laugh at that. And yet, as I say, we still take from this horribly absurd argument. You know, as I say, 99% of this paper, this report, you would say this is absurd. This is crazy. The saints cured the disease. I mean, how would you know that? Even if a saint did cure the disease, how would you know that?
Yeah, it's impossible to prove it. But like, for example, all of these beliefs are very, very old, as you said, and they predate what you're talking about. And the point is, now we've got to try and come out of that. And I'm interested, if I can ask you a question, how do we get this message out? How do we persuade this? My view is, it's the scientists that need to be persuaded. Because the ordinary people are too much enthralled to the higher powers, to the white coats, to the scientists, whatever it is.
Well, it's more than that. I think the scientists, I think a large part of the scientific beliefs was indoctrinated into them before they became scientists. Like, before they went to medical school, they had heard radio programs and television programs about infections. They had heard, like 10 or 20 years from now, you have children today hearing about the Ebola epidemic on television, who will then go to medical school, and it will just be a fact in their mind Ebola epidemic. And if you talk about facts, like, why are the symptoms of Ebola now completely different than they were in the 1970s? Well, why is it called a hemorrhagic fever when most people don't have hemorrhagic symptoms? The press aren't asking those questions. And the press won't ask those questions because they'll be savagely attacked if they start to question the science. And the scientists will lose their job. I mean, it's one of these, it's like a traffic jam. It's like everybody's stuck in place. And if you move, you can't move, or you get punished if you do.
But unfortunately, like, with all of this, is the emperor has no clothes. That's the key point. These pathogenic viruses do not exist. And with that, the germ theory of disease, which I believe is the central dogma of modern medicine. I think modern medicine is composed of a huge number of dogmas or beliefs. For example, and the germ theory of disease is a key dogma. But the Achilles heel, I believe, of modern medicine is the so-called pathogenic viruses do not exist.
It's going to be a little bit embarrassing if one day they have to admit that viruses never existed.
Yeah, well, that's the point. But then there's for example, the work of Dr. Harmer. But I won't go into too much detail. But for example, the concept of metastasis in cancer, where cancer spreads from the liver to normally, like, say you've got bowel cancer, a common secondary cancer would be liver cancer. And they say that that is metastasis or whatever. It spreads in the blood. But yet they don't ban blood transfusions for cancer cells. You know, somebody who's got bowel cancer, can they still give blood? I don't know. I mean, the whole thing, and then the concept, for example, of, Max von, the experiment you're giving about the prisoners that were swabbed with the flu, probably the explanation is that they've got a strong immune system. So it's one kind of hypothesis on top of another. And I guess my belief is that the way to overcome all of this is to say, well, the germ theory of disease is wrong. It's wrong in relation to bacteria, quite clearly wrong in relation to bacteria. And in relation to viruses, it's completely wrong because nobody has ever been able to isolate any of these so-called pathogenic viruses. And that is it. I mean, and really, with all of that, if that is accepted, then a huge chunk of modern medicine goes out the window.
Well, we've run out of time, but I think that's a cogent summary that you just gave.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm with you. I think if the whole existence of viruses is challenged and one day is accepted, that's going to be a shock that allopathic medicine probably cannot recover from. If they're wrong on that, what else are they wrong on?
Precisely. And just to finish off, I will give a plug for the new medicine. And obviously, you've mentioned Jessadora Laker. She's the main proponent, main advocate of new medicine in Canada. And like the work of Dr. Ricky Garrett-Hammer, it does explain the causes of, gives a very good explanation of the causes of cancers and other diseases that are not caused by toxicity.
Right.
So obviously toxicity causes disease, but we exclude all of that, like normal cancers and heart attacks, et cetera, that we all get. Dr. Hammer explains that very well. And I would just like to highlight the point that Dr. Stefan Lanke does accept the German,
right,
the new medicine of Dr. Hammer, very clearly accepted. And a key part is that in relation to Dr. Stefan Lanke, I mean, the key point of all of his work is what he's saying is, I mean, he's a biologist, but in a way, probably what he'll be most famous for is the fact that he's proven that something doesn't exist, which is contrary to what,
I don't think you get the Nobel for that.
Yeah, yes. you don't get a Nobel Prize for proving something.
You don't get the Nobel Prize for proving big institutions wrong. I think I'm more of an environmental cause guy, so we're going to have to agree to disagree on German new medicine and we don't have enough time to go into it. But I would like to thank you very much for joining me today, and I think this was an interesting two-way discussion about the whole question of the existence of pathogenic viruses.
It was indeed, Dave. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Yes, you too. Okay.
Hopefully we'll see. We'll try to get our meet up in the future, hopefully.
Okay. Thanks, Goodbye. James. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 183 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for future guest, email me at david.curro@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.